Hey, welcome to Afikra Movie Night. My name is Mikey Mhenna. Today on the series, we have Amr Salama, the writer and director behind the movie Asma. The movie tells the story of a woman who contracts HIV in Egypt and her struggle to live under that burden. The movie stars Hind Sabri and is a really powerful and gripping movie. You can watch it on Netflix. Ahmed is also behind the Netflix show Paranormal, so we talk about that too. I hope you enjoy the conversation. As always, head over to YouTube if you'd like to watch the conversation and subscribe and leave us a friendly comment. Thanks so much. Welcome to a episode of Afikra Movie Night. Our special guest is Amr Salama, who is a famous director and writer who has written and directed multiple award-winning feature films on A Day Like Today, Asma, Excuse My French, Made in Egypt, Sheikh Jackson, and co-directed the documentary Tahrir 2011, and as well as the person behind Paranormal. We are excited to have you on this series. Ahmed, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
So, you know, I think most people who are familiar with your work, who have recently become familiar with your work, have sort of entered into your sphere through Netflix's show Paranormal, which is how I became familiar with your work. But actually, before we get to that, I want to go back to the very beginning and talk about how you got started. And in particular, talk about this short film, which is available to watch on IMDb. I was so thrilled to see that it was available. So your, I think, student film in 2004, Shahada, is really wonderful to watch. And I have a specific question related to it, which is, when I was watching this film, this 10-minute short, I took a screenshot of a particular film. It reeks Tarantino. And in particular, Reservoir Dogs. And so I was wondering, am I wrong in guessing that he's one of your biggest influences? And if I'm wrong, who were some of your biggest influences growing up?
Sure. First of all, thank you for reminding me of this film. I totally forgot it. I shot it in 2004. That makes it, wow, 19 years now. I feel old.
You feel old.
Yeah. But to answer both of the questions, I was not a film student. I never studied film academically. I've never went to film school. I was actually at that time studying accounting. I had... I can't say love of film. I can say love of art, because I remember when I was a kid, I used to draw a lot. I used to write a lot. I used to miserably try to learn music, but failed. I loved all kinds of arts, and I was more drawn into doing animation, and I wanted to be an animation artist. I wanted to do many things, but the thing that I took seriously was animation, and I started learning animation on my own, taking a couple of like small courses, and then I got more involved in 3D animation. But back then, the scene of animation in Egypt was not that big. It was far from and it still is somehow. It's still far from doing a real 3D animation film like the ones I loved when I was at that age. I was in love with Shrek, Toy Story, all these kind of 3D animation film. I was so blown away by Pixar company and their films. So I decided to maybe be involved more in visual effects. But as I didn't know anyone from the film industry, I didn't know which doors to knock. I started doing stuff on my own until I found myself become a director, because it made sense. It's the thing that literally collects all these skills and talents that I thought I had in one place. So I started making short films on my own with zero budgets. And interestingly, this film you're referring to, El Shahada, is influenced by two things. A book that I read that I loved back then, which was Omati Yaqubian, And of course, Tarantino films, although I'm not the biggest fan of Tarantino, like he's not one of my favorite directors, but I'm influenced by films back then, as all my generation was. So I think I had an influence of Tarantino when I was doing this film. And ironically, the film I'm shooting now, that I'm almost finishing, is somehow influenced by that short film, but in a totally different story. But it was it has somehow the same premise one way or another. So this film, I wrote it, I directed it, and then I wrote it into a feature, and it was really bad. So I kept rewriting, and changing until it became the film that I'm shooting exactly right now. So
what film is that?
It's called Chemerich, which in English we're calling it Fireworks. It's an action film that has a love story and a lot of conflict of interests, like the film Shahada, which I don't think I watched Shahada since I made it, which means like I hadn't watched this film like maybe at least 17 years ago, since 17 years ago.
Yeah,
I don't know if I still have it actually. So so it's a bit nostalgic talking about it, and ironic at the same time, because it's the same idea that kept growing with me until it became the film I'm shooting now.
Yeah, I mean, your films are very layered, and they have these sort of multiple storylines. So walk me through the decision to, you know, start, you leave accounting, you start making these short films. At what point do you say to yourself, you know, I'm actually a writer director, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my career?
Yeah. So back then we had a group of friends. I had a close friend whose older brother and his friends were doing films that they were doing on their own, comedy films that they kept like shooting and editing on their own, and then screening them. Like they would book a cafe and then they screen it in a cafe. And then after that, the films got like before there was internet. It was like back then there was hard disks, so people used to like to like give each other like films on hard disks and stuff like that. So the film got really viral, and everyone in the country watched it. And we were influenced by this group. And me and my friend, we were like the younger generation, although like we're just 2 or 3 years younger. So we started like doing our own film. And we didn't know who's directing. We had discovered by the middle of the shoot that I am the director, because I was the one doing everything. So when we finished that film, like we tried to mimic the experience. So we booked a cafe, we screened it in a cafe, and I printed those flyers, like black and white flyers. I kept like throwing them everywhere in my university and in my club and stuff like that. So people actually came and watched the film, and the moment of first, the film was really bad, and it was trying to be funny and it was not, but people like were super excited about kids like themselves like doing a small film and screening it on screen and stuff like that. So but anyhow, the moment of connection between the audience and the screen, this magical connection between someone sitting on a chair watching something on a screen and emotionally interacting with it. And then, of course, the validation after they watch the film and start like clapping their hands and cheering for us and stuff like that. That moment where I felt like I should be doing this. I was back then, that was 2001, so I was 18, 19 years old. I was studying accounting, and I thought like really, this is what I want to do. Like this magic of this magical interaction and magical connection between someone who's watching and something on a screen that they know that it's not real, but they're still emotionally engaging with it. I felt like this is the magic I want to be involved with.
It's so cool. Okay, so the idea of Movie Night as a series that we try to get people to watch one of the filmmakers' films, and then we get a chance to talk about it. So for anyone who has Netflix, you can find Asma on Netflix if you're just listening to this now. So this is probably a good time to pause and watch it. If not, you can go back and watch it. So let's talk a little bit about Asma as a as a film. And then we'll spend some time talking about some of your other films, including Sheikh Jackson and Excuse My French. And then we're going to talk about Paranormal as well. But the first thing that is clear when you click play on this film is inspired by true events.
Yes.
And this is a wild story. So if that wasn't there, I would think that this is just a crazy story you came up with. That is quite literally unbelievable. But so in your words, if you can just kind of give a brief overview of what the film is and these true events that you're retelling.
Sure.
Because I found them to be, really, really hard to believe.
Sure. So it all started with me, a company called me, a small company back then called me and said, we're doing this very small documentary on people living with HIV. And they wanted me as a director because I was young and cheap. So I started meeting all these people living with HIV in Egypt. And as any Egyptian, especially any young and not very well educated young man, I was not aware of what is HIV, what is AIDS, how should I interact with them and stuff like that. But anyhow, they educated me before I shot the film, before I meet the people. And after I shot this documentary, I felt very touched by their stories and everything. It was a very short documentary. So it was like 11 minutes, something like that. So after that, UNAIDS called me and said, we really want you, we want a sponsor script. And maybe the script, we don't have fund to produce it, but we want to fund the script. Maybe it will find its way. So I took the job and I started writing a script. And of course, I started about thinking about all the cool ideas that are influenced by American films and European films I'm watching. And I was I started crafting this idea and this idea and this idea. And none of them felt real, to be honest. And none of them felt it was the first film I write for hire, which means someone comes to me with a topic or an idea and tell me, can you write about it? So it was very hard. And I wanted to drop out a couple of times. I felt very frustrated because I felt who wants to watch a film about HIV or AIDS? It's going to be very not appealing, to say the least, to the audience. And so I went to UNAIDS. Usama B was the manager back then. And Usama B, I really salute her for having faith in me and in the project. And I told her, I really can't continue this this writing job. So I said, I really can't do it. So she said, okay, before you decide not to do it, and can you come with me to one of the meetings with people living with HIV? So it was in another city. We took the train. I went there. I said, I'm just going to do this meeting for courtesy. I'm not going to write this film anyhow. And I went there. I first thing that touched me was when I got into the room, I found around 20 people living with HIV in one room. And when I got in, the kind of look and their eyes to me when I got into the room, I felt like they're looking at me as if I'm the savior in one way, because they were suffering from stigma and a lot of prejudices and a lot of suffering even from the society and even from their families. So they thought this film's gonna change their lives. So they looked at me as with this look of please save us from what we're living in. And they thought a film would be the way to do that. And I was very touched. And then I kept hearing their stories, and their stories are super painful and super inspiring at the same time. And then I started collecting all this sadness inside me and said, I don't want to continue in this. Although I'm very empathetic and sympathetic for what they're saying, but it's very hard to spend months or years trying to do a film about something that makes you feel that sad. And right after that, just before I was leaving to catch my train, I remember them saying, just met this woman who died a week ago. And this is her story. And they told me the story. And I remember when I heard the story, I was trying to contain myself not to cry in front of them. And then I got into the train with Wissam. and we were going back to Cairo, and all the time when I was going on the trip, I was crying almost the whole trip, thinking about this woman and her real story. And and I remember in that trip, I kept telling myself, I know I'm doing a film that's maybe not commercial, not super appealing to the masses and this and that, but I think if I'm not telling a story that really touched me that much, so why would I continue being in this job? I didn't become an accountant because I didn't just want to work for money. I wanted to work a job where I felt that I belong to and that I have a purpose. So I thought, like, my purpose as a storyteller is when I'm loaded with this emotional charge, I should translate it into a work of art. So I decided I'm going to write this film, and it took literally 3 years to reach a draft that I'm proud of to shoot, and the finances to do the film. 3 years, it was a very, very tough 3 years because I didn't have any source of income. I was just writing this film. And rewriting this film, I wrote it more than 25 times, 25 drafts, until finally you got the chance to shoot it. And we shot it, and it went out right after the revolution. It was a very bad time politically, and there was no safety in the streets. So it was even harder for people to go watch it in the theaters. But until this day, this is the film I'm proud of the most, because I managed to tell a story not just about AIDS, but this woman that I was so inspired by, but I told a story about myself, and I made it as personal as I can to not just make it a film about AIDS. It's a film, at the end of the day, it's a film about me. It's a film about feeling society and the courage to confront society. And it got me a lot of awards, a lot of recognition. And until now, until this day, whenever I meet someone here or abroad or in the States or in Europe, and they told me, what films do I watch for you? I recommend them as well.
You know, I want to play the trailer, which sure. We have loaded up. So let's watch a little bit of the trailer, then have some more questions.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أهلا أعزائي المشاهدين. حب أقول لكم إن الشخصية اللي معانا مش مكئبة نهائي على قد ما هي مبهرة.
عرفينا بنفسك.
أنا اسمي أسماء. أنا عندي إيدز.
لهم مقابر عالمية حاجة حلوة كده تشرح القلب.
أنا كنت بخاف من الظلم، مش عارف أنام إلا لو في نور قايد. دلوقتي بخاف من النور، محدش ليه الحق إنه يسألني المرض جالي إزاي، محدش ليه الحق ده.
مين فيكم يحب ان اسماء تفضل معانا هنا؟
قولي لما بتصلي دايما بتعيطي خشوع؟ ها؟ ولا عارفه انك عملتي مصيبه وعمر ربنا هيسامحك عليها؟
المرض ده جالك ازاي؟
كل واحد مستني المهدي المنتظر، ما حدش عايز يدفع ثمن حاجه ابدا.
هو المسكنات اللي عماله تحنيها في جدتك خلتك ما تبقيش حاسه بنفسك ولا حاسه حتى باللي بيتحرق حواليك.
طب ونفسك في ايه يا اسماء؟
نفسي في ايه؟
شكرا يا اسماء، فرصة سعيدة جدا.
أنا أسعد.
before we keep going, Ahmed, what is it like to watch these scenes?
Very emotional, to be honest. Again, I hadn't watched the film in quite some time. All these memories, all this, it's nostalgic and emotional. I think it was again the film that I shot with a lot of emotions, and I think I still find it in the video. I don't know if people connect with it the way and feel the way I feel, but it was very emotional for me.
Yeah, it was hard to get financing because I mean the. Part of the plot of the story and part of the story is that there is stigma, right? And there's this main protagonist, Esma, who's living in Cairo in, you know, modern day, and she's contracted HIV for, I won't say why and how, but she's contracted HIV and she's afraid to talk about it. And it's actually stopping her from getting a medical treatment for another condition that she has. And she can't talk about it. And it's this huge stigma. And it's actually, I'll out myself by saying that I didn't realize how much of an issue HIV was across the Arab world and in Egypt. But so insofar as there's such a stigma attached to it, was it hard to get financing?
Yeah, it was very hard. It was very, very hard. The film... you can imagine like going in a room to any producer and pitching like, hey, I want to make a film about a woman suffering with HIV. All the keywords you should not say in a pitching room, you know, like first a woman, because back then it was more profitable to make films led by men, male actors. Second, suffering, which is a sad film. It's not a comedy, it's not an action. And third, HIV, which is a big, like, a no-no word, you know, like, and no one's wanna, like, hear about HIV. So I'm not gonna, like, for any producer who think I'm not gonna put millions in a film about something people don't wanna hear about. So yeah. It was really hard. What made it get finances, two things. First of all, Hind Sobri. Having Hind Sobri attached made it a lot easier because a lot of people were excited about Hind Sobri, and the production company that ended up financing the film, they financed the film because they wanted to make a film for Hind Sobri, whatever that film was. So Hind Sobri is one of the biggest reasons why I was able to make the film. Second reason was the script. The first producer that got on the film, Mohammed Hevzi, really loved the script and got touched by it, but still we couldn't have the money to do the film until New Century came on board, the company that ended up producing and financing the film. And together they made the film and it was not a cheap film to make, to be honest as well.
Because there's all these sets, there's all these locations.
Yeah, sets and locations, and especially the makeup, because I wanted to make Hind Sobri look as much as I can to the real character. So the real person she was playing. And so I had to do a lot of prosthetics. That's not her nose. That's not her cheeks. That's not her hair. So we got one of the best makeup artists in the world back then. She was an Oscar nominee. She worked on Nicole Kidman's nose and The Hours. She worked on The Scene Side on Javier Bardem, the makeup of Javier Bardem in The Scene Side, a Spanish film that won the Oscars. So she was like on the top of her game, and she and her team, at least we spent at least a fifth of the film's budget on them. So it was a lot of money, and back then Hind Sobri was pregnant, and she was shooting the film while she was pregnant, and actually in the last couple of months in her pregnancy. So we couldn't shoot more than 8 or 9 hours, which was really tough. So it took us a long time to shoot the film, and so it was not a small budget film.
Yeah. And was Hind aware of the story at the end? You know, the final text. There's a little bit of a revisionist story. You kind of sort of revise the ending. But the true events, was Hind aware of the true events and aware of what, you know, this person's story?
Yeah, that's a funny story, because I remember I wrote this film before even my first film came out. So I was, and nobody knew about me, and I was in this event for HIV, and Hind Sabi was there as a guest. I went to her and said, listen, I'm a new director, but one day I'm going to make this film with you about HIV. And she said, okay, cool. And she was being nice. And then after my first film came out, she actually was one of the actresses that I offered the film to, and she refused it, the first film I made. So after the film came out, she met me by chance, and she said, actually, I didn't like the film, but I liked your directing style so much. I thought, like, you're a really good director.
I love the honesty. I didn't like the film.
Yeah. Hint. That's what I love about Hint. Hint is like no bullshit. Like Hint, like literally does it in your face. So, and that's why it was not an easy journey to write the film, because I was I remember my first film was super like American influenced film. It was I was being a director in the film in every shot. It was super plot driven. So. And after I finished the film, my first film, I thought, like, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to make a film about, like the films I like in the States or in Europe. I want to make a film about Egypt, about real Egyptians. That's the first goal I had. The second goal I had is, like, I want to make a character-driven film, not a plot-driven film. So I read about all these films that I liked about character-driven films. And one of them that really influenced me was There Will Be Blood by PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. And Daniel Day-Lewis. And I remember, like, then Paul Thomas Anderson said, because I wanted to make a character-driven film, I had to sit with Daniel Day-Lewis and write the film almost together. And I wouldn't do anything in the script that he wouldn't do as a character. So it was a collaborative way of writing a screenplay. So I was influenced by that. I said to him the same thing. Let's write this film together. I will not write anything that you wouldn't feel as an actress that you would do for this character. And then I regretted saying that for 3 years, because Hint is a very intellectual human being, and she's very stubborn as well. And that's what I love about her. And she was like, no, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. That's why I wrote the book.
Conveniently, Esma is also very stubborn.
Yes, exactly. And I remember when we first met, Hint told me, why me? Why did you choose me? And I love this question when actors ask me, why me? I said, because you're the most, stubborn person I know. You have this strong personality. And ironically, you're not Egyptian, but ironically, you are the most Egyptian actress in the market. I really believe you're an Egyptian. If I want to, portray an Egyptian girl, Hint Sabi will be the one to go to, although she's not Egyptian. She's the only one who's not Egyptian back then. So we kept writing this for 3 years. It was a very collaborative experiment between me and Hint, and we fought a lot. We disagreed a lot, for 3 years, I kept writing and going back to her, and we kept having this discussion. And she was not convinced at all with the character choice at the end, at all. The reveal, how she conducted dates. So she was like, nobody would do that. Nobody in the world would do something like that. I know it's romantic, it's poetic, but nobody would do that. I said, but the real person did that. She said, I don't believe it. So I kept rewriting, but I really didn't want to lose that, because that was the real story. That was what I loved about the story, the sacrifice. So I thought, listen, I'm going to do my own homework. I went there and I went to UNAIDS. And I asked them, I really want to find a real woman who did something like that and make her sit with him. They found me three.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I told him, please come. I have this meeting. You're going to meet three women with HIV. They want to tell you their stories. I remember that meeting very well. I was sitting outside. Him was in the room meeting one woman after another. And then I remember seeing him coming out of the room, crying like a baby and telling me, I'm convinced now I'm going to make the film. I remember she, and that's why again, it was a very emotional experience for Hind as well. Like, if you ask Hind, if you hung up with me right now and call Hind and tell her, like, what was the most emotional experience you had while making a film? I'm pretty confident she will tell you as Matt.
Yeah. I want to talk about the sort of urban rural also dichotomy that you have going on. You know, a lot of people that don't know Egypt very well, they think Egypt, Cairo, Egypt, pyramids, right?
Yes.
And they think that that's like it.
Yeah.
Whereas Egypt as a country is like almost like, it's like the size of a continent. It's huge.
Yes.
And I think you do a really effective job at showing these two completely different worlds. Is that a world you were also very familiar with before you decided to embark on making the film?
No, at all. And that's why, like, I thought when I was doing this film, I tried to remember the last film that actually was set in a rural town in Egypt. And I couldn't find one in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, wow, why? Because, like Egypt is an agricultural country, and
yeah,
at least 60-70% of the people living in Egypt live in the rural small towns. So I thought, I don't know Egypt, and how can I write about a setting that I've never been to? So again, I was influenced by a film I watched, which was Gandhi, and I remember the journey that Gandhi made in his country when he came back from South Africa and the UK. And he wanted to know his own people. So he took the train and went to all, like, India, trying to understand the people. And somehow I managed to do something like that. I started deciding that I'm going to visit all the governorates of Egypt, which are many. And I started making a call online back then. Facebook was becoming a thing back then. And I was, like, telling people, like, do I know anyone in Fayoum? Do I know anyone in Ismailia? Do I know anyone in Benha? Do I know anyone in Beni Suif? All these cities that I would never go to, like, ever. So I started finding, like, friends, a lot of friends, like, guiding me. And I started doing this trip, sometimes alone, sometimes with friends, to rural towns, small rural. I don't want to go to the big cities. I went to small rural towns to understand the culture, to understand everything. I used to spend, like, 3 or 4 days in each city. And that's the perks of doing a film when you're in your early 20s, because like, you have time for research, you have time for doing all these trips, and you have time to dedicate all your time and energy to your project. You know, you're not, you don't have all these obligations. I didn't have a family. I was not married. I went to the trip. And I understood a lot of it, because I wanted this film to be as authentic as possible. I wanted me to be a discoverer more than an artistic dictator that will tell how the film goes. I wanted to take everything from real life. And I remember I said to myself, I'm not going to put any line in the film or any event in the film that I didn't hear or I didn't find in my research. So that's why the film took a lot of research, 3 years of writing and researching. And I remember there was this diary online. It was like a blog. It was a diary for all the people living with HIV. Everyone anonymously would go on and write their experience. I used to read this blog for like almost 3 years. Wow. I learned all kinds of medications. I met people living with HIV many, many times. Until a point where I started to believe I'm an expert. Like, I remember back then, people, when they had a relative or someone they know that contracted HIV, would call me and tell me, like, what do we do? Because I was the man to go to when you want to ask about HIV back then.
Yeah. I want to talk about the TV show aspect, right? The hot topics. And so for those who haven't seen the film yet, basically the context is there is this like TV show that's very common in the Arab world that discusses taboo topics, societal issues, and often has this like silhouetted character who doesn't want to reveal their face or their name. And they sometimes change their voice too. Is this was this based off the real events? This part of the idea? And if so, do you feel like there's been a change in societal views over the last 10 years? Like, have people in Egypt started to be more empathetic, be more well-informed through these shows? Or do you feel like these shows kind of do a disservice, or they're not that helpful one way or another?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was based on a true story. Asma, the real Asma. That was not her name, by the way. But she decided to go on TV and show her face. But she backed down in the last minute. She changed her mind in the last minute. And she didn't go on TV with her face. And she died almost like a week after the show. Back then, no person living with HIV ever revealed his or her face on television before the show, before the film. And the film, back then, TV shows like these were really, really influencing the Egyptian society, especially there were two or three hosts that were really, really, really influential back then. And it was, if you want to change the country's mind about something, a TV show, like an episode like that would really start the conversation.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case now, that the influence is not that big now, but back then it was the thing. There was no like trends. There were no like, Twitter was not big. Facebook was not big. So TV shows were the way to go if you want to like have a national debate. So, and that was the thing. I also asked myself, this film is about a woman feeding society and she wants to confront society. So what's the best way to do that? Best way to do that in that time was going on TV and says on one of those shows and getting out of the closet and saying what she has. So that was inspired by true events. And sadly, the real character didn't show her face. And then after the film went out, it started to happen that a lot of people actually with HIV went on television and showed their face. And it happened many times after that show, after the film. And I really can't tell and can't claim that I know exactly how the society changed their perspective about AIDS after the film. But based on what they told me in UNAIDS, it made a significant change, especially after it went on television. And I witnessed by myself at least three cases of people meeting me and telling me they have HIV and they came out after the film and their family understood and it wasn't that harsh for them, because literally everyone that I interviewed before the film, from the many, many, many people I met with HIV, none of them told their families, none of them at all. Yeah. A lot of them didn't tell their kids, their wives, their brothers, their sisters, their parents. So after the film went out, I met at least three cases that I remember that told me they told their families after the film went out.
Amazing. I want to change lanes a little bit and talk about some of your other films before we move on, where I want to ask you about Paranormal. You've produced written and directed quite a large number. Insofar as it took you, 3 years to write on finish Asma, where do these ideas come from? Yeah, you told us Asma, but Sheikh Jackson. There's a lot of different types of films. Excuse my French. Where are these ideas coming from?
There's no like magical place where ideas come from. I believe that, but it's all about your rewiring your brain to try to translate everything you hear or see into a film. If you're obsessed about films that much, you can hear any story from your mom, from a friend, from a waiter in a cafe, and you would say to yourself, is this filmable? Can this turn into a story, interesting story to tell? That's how you think. That's how you wire your brain. So your brain by default now like whenever they see, like sometimes you see a film and you expect something and it doesn't happen in a film and that turns into another film you write. So your brain is wired in a way to translate everything into this question, will it turn into a film or not? So, and I'm sure, like, if you work in any profession and obsessed about your profession and obsessed about your work,
yeah,
your brain starts, like, I'm sure you meet anyone in the street and say, like, would this be an interesting episode to, like, make a podcast with this person, yeah, or not? So this is how you, like, if you're obsessed enough, like, it needs a lot of obsession,
yeah,
to wire your brain like that. So that's why I have in my drawer 53 projects that I still haven't made until now. So
yeah.
I write a lot. And I have a lot of stories that I want to tell, because that's the key question. If your conscious and subconscious thinks like that, sometimes you go to sleep at night, you wake up in the middle of the night and your brain wanders and bingo, you have a story, you know? So it needs a lot of obsession and needs a lot of, like, reading, watching films, reading scripts, to have your brain wired like that, to have it function like that, to have it always asking the question, what would be a good story? Does this make a good story to tell or not? And having other elements in your brain, like, will this make money? Will this appeal to an actor? Will this be sold to a producer? Will this be a film for a platform or for theaters or for a TV show? And my waking life, like, at least a good chunk of my day is about that. It's about, what stories should I tell? How can I develop this old idea that I had that never worked on it? And that's I think where ideas come from. They come from obsession and loving your work enough to have this eyeglasses of your work and you see life with it.
Yeah. Okay. So here's a question about Egyptian film. You know, if you go on Google and you type in, like, Egyptian cinema, there's this, like, bifurcated history, right? There's the pre-Nasser, like, golden age of cinema, stuff that you think, you know, the oil painted posters, those films. And then there's obviously contemporary stuff. Do you feel directly connected to that era? Do you feel like you're building on that era, those films from the, you know, 40s, 50s and 60s? You know, we were talking about films that depict Egypt. I mean, like, Yusuf Shaheen did a great job of depicting all these different alleyways of Egypt. Do you feel like you're building on that and you're actually part of the same lineage, or do you feel like they're completely two different things?
No, I feel so, but I believe as well that we are the last generation that will be influenced by that era. Because I remember when we were kids, we didn't have a choice. We only have two channels on television. If you don't watch channel one, you're watching channel two. You have no third option. So you had to watch all these films when you were a kid, and you had to be influenced by them. Like, they were the only option. There was no chance. There was only, like, this show once in a week that would show an American film, and nobody would watch it. And so it was all, like, at least I was 17, 99% of the films I watched were Egyptian films. So, yeah. So of course, I was influenced by them so much. And after I became a professional director and after I started, like, studying the history of film in Egypt, it's so rich. And you can understand politics and you can understand society and you can understand. Sure. All the aspects of life from these films, and you can understand censorship, and you can understand who's running the country and what was the direction of politics back then, and we had great filmmakers, not just Yusuf Shaheen. I love Yusuf Shaheen, but I also love Kamel Sheikh, Salah Abu Saif, Atif Salim, like, a lot of names that did things that were very, very progressive. And when you compare the Egyptian film until at least the 60s, the late 60s, with international films, you would see them, like, head to head with the quality and with the the kind of stories and the kind of experimentation that used to happen.
Yeah.
So after that, of course, after the 70s, there was a drop. But again, you find what I call them, like maybe the Knights or the Musketeers of filmmaking. After the 70s and the drop that happened in the market, you find always at least five directors in each generation which hold the torch and decides to make serious films, important films, and personal films and influential films. And those who are inspirers the most, and I remember, like, this generation, especially the directors of the 80s and the 90s, I almost met all of them. And I'm a geek. I'm the geekiest director you'll find. So I love meeting them and hearing from them the stories behind each film, behind every artistic decision they took, but behind how they conflicted with censorship and society and extremism and everything. So they are a big influence on us. And I remember when I was was starting, I was so influenced by the American cinema back then. And the more I grew, the more I got influenced by more other things, like European cinema. And after that, the Korean cinema. I'm a big lover of Korean cinema. And then after I discovered our heritage more in depth, I started being more influenced by what these directors did in their times, because when I read all the interviews of Egyptian directors in the 40s, 50s, 60s, they almost had exactly our same issue we live with today. Literally, like the star system, the censorship, the politics, the right wing in society, like the conservatism, the extremism. So that's why I think now they influence me more, because we share the same issues, and it's very ironic and a bit frustrating that you discover that after at least 60, 70 years, the same exact problems are still there with doing a film in Egypt.
I want to ask you one more question before we get to paranormal, actually. And it's a question getting into that. So I have on the screen some of the stuff that you've written over the course of your career, and Paranormal sits as the only series. In the US, driven largely by streaming, we see this trend that most of the most interesting storytelling is happening in TV.
I think I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think these are the projects that I wrote.
These are the projects that you've written. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not the ones that you've directed. Yeah, the ones that you've written. So I'm curious about, do you feel like that trend is also happening in the Arab world, where there is more funding going towards series than towards movies, and that there is this sort of migration into serial storytelling versus traditional movies?
Yeah, of course, with the TV channels putting more money in TV series, with the platforms, there are stories now that you really are more suitable, to say the least, to become a series. And sometimes there are to answer this in the shortest ways is that, yes, there are a lot of projects that will have a hard time if you want to turn them into a film. And you will have a better chance if you pitch them as a TV show. You will have a better chance to make them, depending on the idea, how much it costs, and what is the financial return. A lot of factors, the actors, stuff like that. So, yeah, TV became a place where a lot of projects that you thought would have never made it would turn into screen if you turn them into a series or a platform or a flat platform film.
Yeah. Amazing. Were you surprised, pleasantly surprised by the excitement about Paranormal?
I was not surprised. I was more terrified, if I may say.
Why?
Because, Paranormal had hardcore fans. I was one of them. I'm still one of them. I was a hardcore fan of Ahmed Khaled Tawfiq, the writer. I was a hardcore fan of Paranormal, even the other book series he wrote or the novels he wrote. He was like a father figure to me. And once we announced that we're going to do Paranormal, I remember like the expectations and the pressure the fans put on you is unbearable, man. Like it was really, I was like, I felt like I was kidnapping their babies. It was really hard, and they were like really aggressive about like, how are you gonna make, whose actors you gonna choose, who's like which books you gonna like use in the first season, and people in the street would like ask me all the time about it. And I remember when it came out, like the hardcore fans were like, they were not kidding me. Like they were really hard on, like if they didn't like something in the show, they would slaughter you. Even in the streets, I used to meet people in the streets who were angry about this scene or this character or this action sequence or this visual effects, and they would slaughter you in the street. You know, it was like it was serious, as if it's a cult. You know, what was ironic about the show that it actually made better, the reactions on the show internationally were way better than the reactions internally in locally in Egypt, because yeah. Egyptian people were like so hyped about the books, so hyped about the first production, Netflix production in Egypt. So the expectations were like that high. Everyone was being a critic. I remember like, I used to like people who used to send me at least like every day at least 10 or 15 like professional critique from normal people about the show, like a very long critique about the show. I think until now it's the most impactful project I made. Like it made an impact that was beyond imagination. I guess if I'm measuring this by IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes or Cinema.com or the people meeting me in the street, the vast majority loved the show. But those who were really angry at the show, like they were very loud. So yeah.
Because they're always the loudest.
Yeah, they're always the loudest. And I understand that it happens with all the big adaptations, you know, like Harry Potter is the same, like all the films that are Lord of the Rings, it's the same. Like when you go like to adapt a book that has this big fan base, that's what happens.
Amazing. Okay, we're going to end with our films of note. We like to ask you to send over some films that are based off a couple of different questions. So these are somewhat rapid fire. So the first one is film that influenced your most influenced Esma.
Yeah, it was definitely Mare Dentro, The Sea Inside, because I was fond of that director when I was young, Alejandro Amenábar. And Alejandro had an interesting story. He made this small film in Spain. It got a lot of attention internationally. Then he was offered to do a film in the US, and he went to do this film, The Others, with Nicole Kidman. And he made The Others, and it was one of the highest grossing film ever, although it was a very low budget film. So it was a huge success in the States.
Yeah.
So I thought after that, he's going to like direct, of course, like maybe like a Superman or like a Star Wars kind of film. Of course, he can do whatever he wants now. He made this amazing success. But he actually decided that he would go back to his country again, Spain, and find a true story from his country to tell to the world. And that was very inspiring. So I decided I want to do the same back then. Like I kind of connected with that story, and I decided like, yeah, I want to do something from within. I want to dig deep in my culture and tell a story to the world. And that's how I made Esma. And the same thing, there was something, similar about the films, because both have the theme of man against the system or man against the world. So Mahiuddin II was about a man who was trying to, a poet wanted to kill himself, and he was actually filing a lawsuit against the system that he would not allow him to kill himself, because he can't kill himself because he's totally paralyzed. So it was an emotional film. I watched it more than 300 times when I was writing Asma. It was like a screensaver on my screen while I was writing, because it was so emotional, and it's definitely one of my favorite films.
Wow. Amazing. The film that you really loved as a kid.
Of course, Edie. I think if you ask my generation, half of them at least would say E.T. E.T. Yeah. is about friendship. It's about home. And I remember when I watched it as a kid, because back then you were not that able to pick a film you watch. You watch something on TV and it doesn't come back again. So for at least 7 or 8 years, I thought that was a dream that I had. E.T. was a dream I had. Like, I loved it that much. I kept obsessing about it in my head. I didn't watch it again. Nobody watched it with me. I couldn't even verify with anyone that, did you see that with me? A kid with like an alien creature, like being friends. And
this is also an experience that younger people don't know, because if you didn't catch the opening title, you didn't know what the film was called.
Exactly.
And you describe it to friends, but like, there was this thing and they touched and I don't know.
Yes, exactly. I didn't know the name of the film. I literally thought it was a dream until like maybe I was, like, I don't know.
The bicycle and the moon.
Yes. And it sounds ludicrous, right? When you tell it to someone who didn't watch the film, it's like, what are you talking about? What bicycle flying? And I remember like, until I was like 14, 15, 16, I watched it. I found it. Like, I watched it and I was like, that was real. That was not a dream that I had when I was a kid. Like, I spent years thinking that was a dream I had.
I had the exact same thing with the Gremlins.
With what?
The Gremlins. Do you remember the film?
Yeah, sure.
Many years later, I was like, oh, wow, that was a real movie. I thought I dreamt that.
Yeah. That's how valuable films were when we were kids. It's like, if you want to find a film and watch it, that was a journey. That was an adventure.
Exactly.
Like, and sometimes you had to wait for 2 months in the video store to find the tape when someone returns it back.
A film that is so underrated.
Yeah, Zodiac. Zodiac I'm a big fan of David Fincher. Like, he's one of my favorite directors of all time, and he's a true mastermind. And Zodiac was the least successful film for him. And it's the only film that he made that he didn't make money. And I remember watching it in the theater the first time. It was super long, although I really, really enjoyed it, and I watched it I think three times in the theater. And I loved the authenticity of it and how much he wanted to tell the story as it is, and being true to the source material and to the true story. And that's why I love the film. And although when people who are not very familiar with David Fincher, if you tell them like Fight Club, they would know it. Seven, they would know it. Case of Benjamin Watson, Girl, Dragon Tattoo, any of his films, they would be very familiar with them. Except maybe Zodiac and his last film, Monk. But Zodiac, I really think is a masterpiece that was not didn't have the reaction that, of course, they wished for.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. As I was watching Asma, I feel like you used color very effectively.
Yeah,
in kind of a Finchery way, where it's sort of, there's the like the greenish blue of the television world, and there's the very vibrant, radiant of the rural world, and then there's the muted tones of her life. I think you did that really, really effectively.
That's also influenced, I guess, by the films I watched in the 90s and the early 2000s. Yeah. I was studying cinema, like Fincher films, and actually the Matrix did that brilliantly back then.
Yeah, the Matrix for sure. Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we have a few more. The film that that film students must watch.
Yeah, Separation is another masterpiece. And I would recommend it to film students for one thing. It's all about the story is king. So it's not about how you shoot it. It's not about how famous the actors are. It's not about how big the film is. You can tell a story that is so simple and still make an award film, winning film, a film that wins an Oscar, wins at Cannes. I always say about Asghar Farhadi that the director.
This is a Persian film, right?
Yes. And the director, Asghar Farhadi, the interesting thing about his films is that it sounds like the stories my mom told me when I want to hang up, like about the neighbor who like did this with his wife, or and those boring stories that I would never make a film about that, you know? And he managed to make films about what I call the stories of my mother. And he does them brilliantly and he makes them with genre. It's like a mystery film done in a real setting with the real stories of real people. So I think Asghar Farhadi is the director nowadays that you should learn from, because it's about how he crafts a story. Real stories that you don't need a lot of money, you don't need the best camera in the world, you don't need this or that. You just need good story, good acting, and you do a film that can travel and can impress the whole world.
Amazing. A film that always makes you laugh.
Yeah, Ya Rab Walad, Samir Ghanem. This is like the perks of what we used to call the era of construction films, like construction cinema. We call it like that because back then people used to make films to just put them in VHS and send them to the Gulf countries to sell them. Back then, films were making a lot of money. If you make a cheap film, you're going to make a lot of money. So a lot of like people working in businessmen working in construction started producing films because it was more profitable than working construction. That's why we call it the construction era. So, nice. So the construction era, Cinema Al-Maulat, was like the worst films you can ever watch. But the perks of that era is that it had a lot of creative freedom and people would just have fun making a film. So Ya Rab Walad is supposedly one of the films in this era, but still, it's one of the best films of this era. And Samir Ghanem is my favorite comedian of all time in Egypt. And in this film, I know his lines word by word. I can literally, when the film going, like, say it all with him, because it was so fun. And you don't care about the story, you don't care about anything. You just care about Samir Ghanem being on screen, saying his lines. It's so fun.
That's awesome. Film that you rewatch all the time.
Of course, Fight Club. Fight Club is the film that made me obsessed with cinema. And Fight Club is the film that is, I always say, if I would make a PhD, I would make it about Fight Club. It was an obsession when I was a kid, and it still is an obsession. Every time I watch it, I discover new things in the film. Whenever I feel frustrated or like hating my job, which is I feel like at least every week, I would go watch Fight Club again to remember why I love cinema.
Amazing. And the last one I'll make you do is a film that most changed how you think.
Yeah, A Serious Man. A Serious Man is another underrated film. It's one of it's a film by Coen Brothers.
Yeah,
and it's one of the least films they like. They got claimed for. It's a film about God, about faith, about life, about the meaning of life. And I love it. I love it so much because it's so deep. It's hilarious. I find it hilarious. And it really asks very interesting questions about life and the meaning of life. That's why I remember when I watched the film the first time, I didn't get it at all. But I felt that there's something interesting about that film. And then I got the chance to watch it again. And when I watched it again, I felt like, wow, it made me think a lot. This is the film I watched and made me think a lot.
Yeah. No, I love the serious man. Ahmed, thanks so much for doing this. I want to wrap up.
Thank you.
This was a lot of fun. I highly recommend everyone, if you haven't seen Esma, it's on Netflix. It's a really, really interesting film, and it sheds light on a topic I didn't know enough about. Ahmed, thanks so much for your work, and hopefully we'll get to meet each other soon.
Hopefully. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Thank you so much.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we do, go to hafikata.com, where you can learn about our Zoom events, our live events in 30 different chapters around the world, our social media presence, and our podcast and YouTube stuff. You should know that everything we do is all towards a mission of converting passive interest in the histories and cultures of the Arab world into an active intellectual curiosity. By listening to this, you're a part of that movement, so thank you for being here. If you'd like to support our work, go to hafikata.com/support and join the hundreds of people around the world who make this work possible. Thanks.